This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. It's my pleasure to welcome Darren Bloomquist to the show. He is Vice President at Realty Track and Executive Editor of Realty Track's Housing News Report. Darren, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
You're coming to us from my old hometown, Irvine, California.
Yes, that's right. Beautiful Irvine, California. It's extremely hot here right now, but usually we're doing really well in terms of the weather here.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, hey, what is going on in the housing market? You know, the U.S. is so unique. It's such a large real estate market consisting of about 400 distinct metro areas. And I just can't stand it, Darren. I'm sure this drives you crazy, too, when these talking heads come on television or the radio or whatever, and they talk about the housing market as though it's one big entity. I mean, that's, you know, they don't understand the concept of geographical segmentation, much less price segmentation and demographic segmentation. And there's so many ways to slice it and dice it, right?
That's true. And there's certainly some things you can see, some very high-level trends you can see with the national numbers, but ultimately it is each market is different, has a different set of circumstances. But, you know, that doesn't sound very good, and getting that nuanced about the data doesn't work very well for the sound bites. But, certainly we love to talk about our data is ultimately down to the address level. So we're extremely local. We're not, you know, the data we put out on the housing market is not a survey of realtors. It's not a projection. It's based on publicly recorded documents, sales documents, mortgage documents, foreclosure documents that tell us what's happening. And every single number that we have in our reports comes back to a document that was recorded for an individual property. So we love that we can, we can roll the numbers up to that high level, but then we can get very granular too and see what's happening at the metro level, those 400 metro areas you talked about, at the county level, we have data for, on most of this data, we have it for well over 2,500 counties nationwide. And then even down to the, city and zip code level and then address level.
So is that really what your company does? I mean, you're a data company, right? How did Realty Track start? I don't think I ever knew the answer to that question. I've had you guys on the show a couple times.
Sure. Yeah. We've grown into a data company. And really our roots are in data too. In 1996, gentleman in Southern California, it was foreclosure data. He realized that it was somewhat archaic the way that realtors specifically learned about foreclosures. They would get them a printed list mailed to them. There were services that provided that. That was about the time where the internet was really starting to come on, and so he thought, why not make this more efficient by posting this data on the internet bulletin boards for people to find for realtors. And it was really specifically targeted at realtors in Southern California. But then we acquired nationwide foreclosure data around 2000 and started providing this nationwide. And consumers as well expressed very very much interest in this data. It wasn't, you know, not just for realtors or even the real estate investors who would have the connections to get this information, but for any real estate investor and any consumer. And that really, the business really took off once we, what we call it democratizing the foreclosure data. And then just in the past year and a half, we've expanded the data set even more to include not just the foreclosure records that we license and provide, but exponentially broadened it to include sales data, all the sales that are recorded on properties, as well as mortgages and property assessor information. So that widens the scope from data on about 20 million properties historically that have had some type of foreclosure notice on them to now 130 million properties that pretty much all properties that exist in the United States.
Right. So you've got, and I want to ask you about some of the trends, but just one more quick question about the industry, like your industry and your competitors, if you will. So you've got these different data companies out there, and you know, many of them admittedly are more than data companies, but you've got CoreLogic, which I believe is no longer affiliated with First American, if I'm not mistaken, but I don't know. You know, CoreLogic, Fidelity Title has a data company of some sort. There's Zillow, Trulia, which is now one. You see Redfin is sort of, I think, wanting to play in that space a little bit. You know, what's the distinction between those? Just quickly. I mean, the listeners want to know about the real estate market, but...
Yeah, very quickly. We would really consider ourselves in this data licensing space as one of three competitors. CoreLogic is the other one, and Black Knight is the third one. And Black Knight, formerly LPS. We're the only three companies that have the ability to license this data, to resell it. So actually, companies like Zillow and Redfin would be customers of ours. Now, they get the data and can play with it, but they're licensing it. They ultimately don't own it, and they have restrictions on their use for it, whereas we have the ability to license this data to other people. They're licensing it from us. So that's really the bottom of the pyramid are these three companies that have the data, at least nationwide. There's other smaller companies that would have this locally, but those would be the three nationwide who have the ability to, who are collecting that public record data and then also have the ability to relicense it, resell it to other folks.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good stuff. So you said at the beginning, we bemoaned the fact that, you know, the sound bites and the big media don't understand the old saying, all real estate is local, which we fortunately do, and our listeners do, mostly at least. So what are the big high-level trends that you could say are happening to the, quote, housing market, unquote? You know? And then let's drill down and talk about some specific markets.
Yeah, I think one that holds true, it's very broad-based, that shows up in the national numbers, is the number of sales being very strong this year. We're showing home sales through the first 6 months of this year are at an 8-year high, the highest level they've been at this time of the year, going all the way back to 2007. And that's not just nationwide, but that we looked at it at the market level. And now for this, we analyzed 190 markets, so not quite all 400 of those markets you talked about, but the big ones, the larger markets. Out of 190 markets across the country, 65% of them did have similarly an 8-year high in home sales like we saw at the national level. So that's a big trend that's happening in many markets, that home sales really, this especially in the second quarter, have really taken off. And this is, when I say home, I'm talking about single family and condo and townhome sales of properties that have taken off. That is one big trend, and we can talk about this further, but I think that's driven, there's a few things that are driving that, but it's really good news that this recovery is spreading, is broad-based. It's not just an investor-driven recovery, which is real estate investors really helped set the floor back in 2012 and helped this recovery, kick this recovery off. But now we're seeing first-time home buyers, other traditional buyers participate, and that's why we're seeing those home sales numbers at eight-year highs in many markets.
So the home ownership rate has been declining, which I, oddly, no one will agree with me on this too much, but I think that's really a healthy thing. I think it was too high. I think that the real home ownership rate, if we didn't incentivize and subsidize and do all this stuff that we I don't think should be doing, I think the real home ownership rate should be about 50%. You know, about half.
Wow.
And I know, I believe me, I
pretty
get
extreme.
I get a lot of flack from that. Yeah, see? Do you hate me for saying that?
No, I don't. Hey, you know, I would say, we're not completely agnostic, but we're fairly agnostic about the data. I mean, we don't have, honestly, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to us if home ownership rate is at 50% or at 70% like it was during the height of the market. We don't have a membership that is depending on home ownership rate to be high. The people who are buying the data from us, you know, they're just trying to determine how to react to how the market is behaving. So, I think 50%. I do have, you know, more of a personal rather than a company opinion. Is that home ownership is good for many people and it does help them build wealth. But I also agree that the data proves that we were at a too high a level of home ownership. Home ownership is not for everybody, and there was a segment of people who were buying homes who had no business being homeowners during the last bubble.
No question about it. And, you know, home ownership in many ways, surprisingly, I know it's contrary to popular belief, but it's bad for people because it lessens their mobility and increases unemployment, doesn't let them go where the jobs are when they need to move for jobs. So it's not all it seems to be. I used to completely believe that. Also, I changed my view on that a few years back. But that's sort of another discussion maybe for another day. So, first of all, what do you see in some of the markets? I mean, you're gauging price trends. Are you also monitoring rent versus own population in various markets? You monitoring anything that might relate to cash flow or the what might interest an investor in investing in a certain market?
I think pretty much all of what you said. You know, the rent versus own is one thing that stuck out to me. We can tell from the tax assessor information if the property is a rental or well, I can't say it for sure it's a rental. We can tell if it's owner-occupied or non-owner-occupied. And certainly we're showing that, and I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, so I'm pausing here, but there's about 16 million homes, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact percentage nationwide. I can figure it out of about 80 million, so we can do the math there. That we show as non-owner occupied, and so those would be rental properties and vacation homes, and it's interesting to look at that from market to market. That's one of the things we track, and certainly as home ownership rates have gone down, that market has become bigger. It's been a market that Wall Street has been attracted to, of course, as well, that kind of single family rental market. But yeah, that's certainly one thing we track. We look at home prices, which that's another, I would say, fairly consistent trend across many markets. Although this is where I think we start seeing more variation. But when we look at median home prices in July, our data shows us that they're at the highest level since September 2008 nationwide. But the rate of appreciation is slowing down pretty dramatically. We're up 2% year over year, whereas even earlier this year and last year we were seeing double-digit appreciation in home prices. And then when you start looking at markets, you start to see markets consistently, many of them slowing down to single-digit appreciation, and even a few going negative for a month or two this year. So there's definitely some softness in home prices. That I don't necessarily, just like you don't consider home ownership rates being a bad thing, I don't think home price appreciation slowing down is necessarily a bad thing for the market. But we're definitely seeing that happening.
Yeah, there's this funny belief in just sort of everybody's psyche, and I think it's just silly, Darren, that, you know, a good market is when prices are going up like crazy, and a bad market is when prices are either flat or declining. But, you know, it depends who you are. that should be a relative thing for everybody, but it's just strange how those beliefs become adopted.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And there, yeah, there's this feeling like if things are not continuing to go up, at least very dramatically, then somehow the market is struggling. And this is, to me, an expected cooling off that's necessary because of the affordability issue that many markets are facing. And so it's expected in many ways, and it's actually a sign that the market is behaving rationally.
But I'm kind of curious. We sort of went down this road that actually surprises me a little bit, because it seems like every market that my real estate company is in is just booming. I mean, businesses, you know, it's hard to find, you know, like, in other words, the deals ain't as good as they used to be, you know, to use a little slang here. It's getting just harder to get a good deal and to get that rent-to-value ratio that investors really like. That's becoming more challenging. Where are you saying, you're saying it's cooling off in some areas. Where do you see that, by the way?
Oh, yeah, and so when I say cooling off, too, I think the mental image is, oh, those markets are doing poorly. The prices are still going higher, but at a much slower rate. I mean, I think certainly, Phoenix is always a good market to look at. I consider it a bellwether market. And we've seen over 6 months now, not close to 9 months, I believe, that have been single-digit appreciation. Home prices are still going up. And the other thing that makes some of these markets not feel like they're cooling off as much is there's still not a ton of inventory available for sale. And so buying homes is very competitive. But even in the Bay Area of California, we're seeing home prices slip down to about 10% appreciation, where it was 20, 30% appreciation in the last few years.
Oh, where is my violin?
Yes.
I'm telling you, where is the violin?
yeah, and so it's, you know, the cooling is in the prices, and that's a rational behavior. It doesn't mean that it's easy to find a deal. Because inventory is low, and particularly one of the hallmarks of this market that we're seeing now is very low foreclosures. In fact, we're now seeing foreclosure starts. What we consider foreclosure starts are properties that receive their first public notice of foreclosure. And those are at a 10-year low as of July. And in fact, they are lower than they were prior to the crisis. If we compare the number of foreclosure starts we're seeing now this year on average, they're averaging less than they were in 2005 and 2006 before the bubble burst. And so that tells me there's not only is there less inventory overall, but particularly for real estate investors who are looking for that bargain that could be represented by a foreclosure, it's really hard to find that because of these extremely low foreclosure rates.
Okay, so where is the market going? You know, what does your crystal ball say? This is what everybody wants to know. If you divide the nation up into three market types, and by the way, I'd love to know, you know, feel free to poke a hole in this, but this is the way I view it. The linear markets that just chug along, they're kind of boring, but they're good, solid investment markets. And then the cyclical markets, the high flyers, they're always making the news. They're very sexy and terrible, you know, depending on which end of the cycle you're on. And then the hybrid markets, and Phoenix is a hybrid market that's kind of in between the two. By the way, do you agree with that assessment of the three market types? Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it quite in that context before, but I think I buy that. I mean, the hybrid one, I think it's harder to define, probably, at least in my mind, and you probably have a great definition. But yes, there's definitely, and I've experienced this personally. I grew up in the Midwest, and now I'm in California, and seeing the difference in those markets, and then seeing the data is really interesting to look at. So yeah, I would in general agree with that classification.
If we look at it that way, You know, where do you think, like, what does the crystal ball say for, I mean, they all act in almost lockstep. You know, it's not like they're extremely different if you divide them up those three ways. You know, like, if one of the talking heads that got on TV, you know, you see him on CNBC, if they would say that way, not the housing market is doing this or that, if they would say, well, the cyclical markets are doing this, the linear markets are doing this, and the hybrid markets are doing in between the two. You know, so what would your outlook be for some of these different market types?
Yeah, I think there's actually more upside with the boring markets. I'm sorry, I forgot what you called
the linear markets. Yeah,
the linear markets. Sorry, yes.
Boring. We do not take offense to boring as long as it gives good ROI.
Oh yeah, I love boring. Boring is predictable, right? Those markets. Actually, at this point, I think have more upside. What we're seeing there is some of those boring markets. One of the things that stood out to me on this whole price piece is that among major markets of, I believe that the threshold was 500,000 or more, in July, there were 10 markets where we saw a new all-time high in home prices, not home sales, but median home price. And the first two of those markets, okay, those would probably, I think you define as, the first one is hybrid, it's maybe Denver, Colorado. Then the second one is San Jose, which is the cyclical. But then most of the rest, I think, would fall under your definition of linear. We have Columbus, Ohio, Nashville, Raleigh, Omaha, Colorado Springs, Madison, Boulder, in Burlington, Vermont.
Boulder would not be linear. Boulder would be cyclical too, or at least hybrid, or hybrid probably, yeah. Because Boulder's an expensive market, you know, very constrained and,
yeah,
you know,
I can definitely see that there. So, but what I see is those, because those markets, the ones that are experiencing, of course, solid underlying fundamentals, that's a key component here. Those have more upside we're just seeing in the numbers, I think that maybe because people are willing to move there for jobs and they see the affordable housing is icing on the cake, and so we're seeing prices recover. And of course, in many of those markets, prices did not go down as dramatically during the downturn. So that's the linear markets. The cyclical markets are also doing very well and seeing home prices getting, in many of them, getting close to their all-time highs. And that's, you know, when I think of the cyclical markets, I think of mostly a lot of the coasts, California coast, also places like Seattle and South Florida and New York and those sorts of markets. They're doing very well, but the challenge I see in those markets is affordability. And that's not necessarily bad for the real estate investor, although it definitely can be, but it, you know, for the traditional buyer, those markets are just extremely unaffordable, and I think at some point that becomes a risk factor for those markets. And the hybrid markets are you know, probably in a very good position as well. Without typically the affordability is not as much of an issue in those, at least the ones I'm thinking of in your the way you described it.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. So if you were investing right now, what would you be doing? Or maybe you are investing right now, buying properties. You know, what advice would you give to investors now?
Sure. And yeah, I definitely dabble in investing. It's great to have this data at my fingertips and own a couple rental properties. And now we own in Southern California, which is not the best place to own a rental property. But, you know, I think some of the places that I mentioned there that have that combination of jobs, and a lot of them are university towns that I just mentioned that have these new home price peaks. Markets that with that combination of jobs but are still affordable are attracting the younger potential buyers and or renters. So places like Columbus, Ohio, even though it's at a new home price peak, the median home price there is $155,000. So, you know, you can make a rental property work there very, very easily. But you also have, I would be looking at places like that to invest.
We like Memphis and Atlanta and Columbus. We do business there too a little bit. Not that much in Columbus. Indianapolis has been great for many years. And just these linear markets, I mean, Orlando, you know, those kinds of places, they just work. You know, you can make the cash flow work. And that's the key to having a sustainable real estate portfolio. What's going on with foreclosures? I know we got to wrap up here, but, you know, what's happening in the foreclosure world? It's interesting to me. I just did a show, well, two today, actually, talking to someone from our Chicago market, which we do a little business in the outer Chicagoland area where it makes sense. Also talking to someone from Orlando. And, you know, with these judicial foreclosures, I mean, they've still got a foreclosure market. You know, it's just crazy versus the other markets where there's been price discovery and market clearing already that are, you know, long past that cycle. And I know which way I'd rather see it happen, you know, discover price quickly and move on. That's the way it should be. But
right, yeah. But rip the Band-Aid off.
It hurts more when you take it off slowly. Exactly. Very good metaphor.
Yeah. So, yeah, we are seeing the consequences of that kicking the can down the road, and we're seeing it fairly widespread, but it's definitely most dramatic in the states that have that judicial foreclosure process that's more extend the philosophy of extend and pretend, and those are the markets where we're seeing this kind of resurgence.
Extend and pretend. I love that. Extend and pretend. That's good. In other words, the people get to pretend they're not going into foreclosure because they get extended forever. Go ahead.
Exactly. I've also heard it called delay and pray. There's
delay
all
and pray.
Little,
that's good too.
Yeah. And that, you know, that strategy, I'm giving it too much credit to call it a strategy, but that playing out of the way the market worked in some of these is definitely turning out to hurt these markets and cause them to lag more than other places. So looking at specifically at bank repossessions, this final stage of foreclosure, I mentioned earlier, foreclosure starts at a 10-year low. So there's not a lot of new people going into foreclosure. But this backlog or shadow inventory, whatever you want to call it, of people who have been in foreclosure for years and just have never completed the process, we're seeing more of that get flushed out in starting with the nationwide trend, and then I'll drill down to some of these markets. In July, we saw a 30-month high in these REOs, these bank repossessions nationwide. And these REOs were up in 44 states, so it was pretty widespread. But if you look at the judicial states, that's really where we see the problem.
I just want to point something out there, though. You call it a problem, and I agree with you, it's a overall problem, but that means opportunity for investors, too. You know, it's kind of like in those markets, you're operating in 2011 or 12. It's sort of like you get to rewind by maybe 3, even 4 years, you know, versus the other markets, they had mostly cleared by, say, 2012. Would you agree with that, by the way?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way of saying it. This is, you know, from a perspective of an investor, if you feel like you missed out on, you know, the buying frenzy in some of those other markets, there's still this last gasp, it looks like, of opportunities to buy these bank-owned properties in some of these markets. So Florida, I think you mentioned, REOs are up 78% year over year in July. Ohio up 69%. New Jersey is one of the highest. It's almost unbelievable, up 344% in terms of these REOs. And not surprisingly, New Jersey is a state with the absolute longest foreclosure timeline in the country. Based on our data, we're showing on average it takes 1,200 days to complete a foreclosure there. And that's average. I mean, we hear the horror stories of it taking
3 years,
5, 7, 8 years.
Oh my God, that long? I was saying three, but
yeah, three is Well, at 1,200 days, we're talking about definitely over about 4 years. So, and that's New Jersey, and New York's also in that category of very long, in Florida, and that's where we're seeing some of the biggest increases in these bank repossessions, which and that's just really in the past 3 to 6 months that we've been seeing that in most markets. So I would suspect what that means is in the next 3 to 6 months going forward, we'll start to see more of those bank repossession, bank REOs turn into actually being listed for sale, the banks putting them up and making them available to purchase.
Yeah, very interesting. So those markets are more slow to recover. That's the upshot of this. And that's what we're seeing. You know, we're just seeing it play out that way. So it's very interesting. Are there any things going on, you know, in the, just as we wrap up here, in the political environment, or, you know, with Fannie Mae or FHA or, you know, Freddie Mac, or, you know, anything there that you see on the horizon that is going to influence the market one way or another? I mean, you know, a few years ago, it was, they're going to let Fannie Mae go. It's just, you know, they're going to let it go out of business like a regular company, like they should. And that would have, see, I'm another weirdo in real estate, and I say, let Fannie Mae die, you know, and prices will go down, rents will go up, everything will adjust. In a couple years, it'll be back to normal. Maybe.
Yeah, I think I would actually tend to agree with that. Maybe I'm willing to say that because I know there's very little possibility of that actually happening, given the political environment. But yeah, we don't, you know, in terms of that specific question, we don't see that happening anytime soon. What we do see is that we've reached the tipping point where the reaction to the housing bubble burst was to reduce risk in the market. But now we're seeing the balances tilt back toward introducing more risk in the market. Fannie just introduced a program, I don't know if you've heard of this, where for loans, that one of the loan programs that they're proposing would be one where income from non-household borrowers could be included in the income to qualify the buyer. So in other words, they're billing it as something that would be good for multi-generational households, or someone like you can include income from a basement tenant, they even say in there. So that's one example of, okay, they're realizing affordability is an issue in a lot of these markets. People are not making enough income to afford the home prices. So they're introducing what I would consider is a more risky loan product. FHA has, at the beginning of this year, introduced lowered their insurance premiums, which introduces more risk into the market. And that's one of the big themes I'm seeing going forward, is it's been a very risk-averse market from a policy perspective, and now that seems to be, the pendulum seems to be swinging back. And also on the foreclosure side, the pendulum is swinging. You know, it had been give people more time to make sure that they can avoid foreclosure. But I think, as evidence with this recent surge in REOs, we've also reached a tipping point there where it's, okay, we've given people enough time. These lingering foreclosures are only hurting the market at this point. The best course of action is to resolve these and get them into the hands of a new homeowner.
Yeah, very good point. So your website, realtytrack.com, are there any other specific resources you want to refer people to, Darren?
Sure, realtytrack.com has a lot of this information at the local level. If you go to the stats and trends section, you can type in a zip code even, or a county or state, to see some of these trends I've been talking about, and that's completely free. Our subscription product allows you to research at a property level at realtytrack.com and neighborhood level. And then we also, if you're looking for custom reports to say, okay, what's happening in Indianapolis or Memphis, should we be getting into that market, or should we be pulling back out of that market? Our data solutions team can help prepare customized reports for you, and you can contact them through data.realtytrack.com.
Excellent. Darren Bloomquist, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.